This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station Joy 94.9.
Matt Davis, thanks for taking the time to talk with Experiment Q and welcome.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
So looking at your CV, it seems you've had quite an interesting life and career. You've studied in Scotland, England and Australia, and you've had work experience in Thailand, South Africa, Namibia, and you're a US citizen, and now you're settled in Australia. So what brought you here?
Quite a few things, actually. I traveled to Sydney for a holiday with my family back when I was in undergrad. It would have been 2011, 2012. And I fell in love with Sydney and I fell in love with Australia. And I knew that I always wanted to, if I had the chance, come back. And an opportunity arose where one of my master's project supervisors, her PhD supervisor, who's based in Sydney, was interested in working with me. So I had a chat with him and we just kind of sorted it out and I ended up here.
So was it your love of kangaroos that brought you here as well? Or was that kind of like just something that you fell into?
Kangaroos is actually something I did fall into. I originally came to Sydney to actually continue my master's research, which was on looking at large herbivore communities in Botswana, particularly around artificial waterholes. And as sometimes PhDs go, or any sort of fieldwork research goes, things happen that don't work in your favor. And unfortunately, I had to scrap that project. And my supervisor said, hey, I have this interesting backup project on kangaroos. Would you be interested in doing that instead? And I said, yes. So that kind of kangaroos kind of just came out of nowhere. It was a nice plan B, but so far loving it.
And it's such an Australian thing to study. So you're kind of doing the right thing.
Yeah, exactly. It was kind of like, well, and at least now, no, there's no strange questions of, oh, if you're studying large African mammals, what are you doing here? So now it's a little bit, it makes a lot more sense when people ask me what I'm doing here.
It does. So the thesis you're currently working on, I think the title is Kangaroo Movement and Behavior in Western New South Wales, the relationship between kangaroos, feral goats, and water resources. So you're just at the beginning stages of this research, as I believe, but what are you hoping to find out, or what are you hoping to discover with this research?
The project's kind of divided, I would say, into three main parts. The first is looking at kangaroos and goats and how they're moving and utilizing their landscape. So it's more of a spatial use study. The second part is looking at water as a resource. So quite similar to what I've done in Southern Africa when it came to setting up motion sensor remote cameras, looking at what species are utilizing different water resources and how they're utilizing them. So looking at daily drinking patterns, if there's seasonal shifts in utilization, and looking at if there's any sort of interspecific competition between different species. And then the third question, which we're working with a few collaborators, is counting kangaroo populations. So seeing, looking at the best methods for estimating kangaroo population size, and then outlining the different costs and benefits of each method.
So you mentioned the artificial water sources. Is that something that you'll be looking at in this research, yes?
Yeah. So most of the water sources out in arid Australia tend to be boreholes, so water that's been drawn up from underground. So those are all artificially pumped. So that's kind of the main focus. There are a few natural water sources around, but they're few and far between out in the outback. So,
right. So I'm just trying to understand why that's significant about the artificial water holes. Is it just they're just there because they'll obviously bored for human consumption, but now animals use them. But why is that significant in the research that they're artificial rather than natural water holes?
I think one of the big things when it comes to artificial water sources, I mean, national parks use them as well. And there's a big shift because of climate change and changing land use, because there is an energy cost to keeping artificial water holes pumping. There's also water costs. So it comes down to keeping certain ones open, shutting some down, seeing how that impacts different communities when it comes to ecology and different species. And it's particularly important these days, as I think most people in Australia know, that the country's been experiencing a massive drought. So there is a huge question on water resources and how best to keep those running sustainably, or if they're needed at all. Because there are a lot of species that don't particularly rely on water sources because they get a lot of water from their food intake. So that's a huge question at the minute. And I think that's why we're looking at one portion of the project, looking at what species are actually using these water sources and how are they using them, because there's very little information out there on that.
So what's the specific reason for looking at feral goats in combination with kangaroos?
So feral goats was another one that just kind of fell in my lap. So I think at least so my field site is in Fowler's Gap, which is a pastoral multi-use farm outside of Broken Hill, that's owned by UNSW, so the university I'm working through. And the big three largest herbivores that have a big impact on the landscape are kangaroos, which it's four different species of kangaroos, and then feral goats and sheep that are farmed for their meat and their wool. I guess the big, there's been quite a lot of research on how kangaroos and sheep interact, but there's been very, very little on how goats and kangaroos interact. So we were fortunate enough that we're collaborating with a few different people that have access to collars or tracking collars for goats. So we're hopefully going to be able to compare those to the collars we're putting on kangaroos to map their different land use movements and home ranges.
So they're like GPS collars, they track their movements and where they're moving around the areas.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll be using GPS collars that log GPS points, and then at the end of the study, radio VHF technology to go out and find the collars and then extract all the data.
So you mentioned that you'll be heading out into the field shortly. So what would a typical day look like for you out in the field? What sort of things would you be doing on a daily basis?
I mean, it's quite a range of different things. So when I first go out there, it will be mainly for collaring, so putting the tracking collars on kangaroos and goats. So that can take weeks. I think we're planning to collar up to 30 kangaroos. And then there's up to 60 goats. So it's quite a lot of work, and it takes a few hours out of every day to locate animals, to dart them using a tranquilizer dart, then putting the collars on, and then kind of standing around waiting for them to wake up to make sure they're all okay, and then move on to the next. And as it's out in the desert, you can't really do a lot during the middle of the day when it comes to working hands-on with animals, because you don't want any of the animals to overheat. That's kind of a typical morning during the collaring would be going out collaring one, if possible, two animals. And then the rest of the day would kind of be doing checking camera traps that I've put out at water holes, or doing some different transects. I'm planning on doing line transects for cars, so attaching cameras to cars and seeing if we can count kangaroos essentially from video footage, and then also doing on the same transects drone surveys, so flying a drone and taking video. And then in the heat of the day would be mainly sitting in an office going through camera trap images or going through drone footage or video footage, trying to start to compile it all for then analysis later on.
You mentioned transects. What's transects?
So transex would really just be any sort of set distance on a set tract, essentially. So it might be a 1 kilometer stretch on this selected piece of road that you would do multiple replicates of that drive every, it could be every day, it could be twice a day, it could be every other day, it could be once a week. And so you just have this continuous video footage of this one line, and you'd have multiple lines to compare them.
Right, so surveying the same piece of land, basically.
Yeah, so a survey transect or a survey line.
So obviously the current bushfire crisis in Australia must be distressing for you, seeing all the impact on wildlife and the kangaroo population. What's your take on the current situation?
I mean, fortunately, my study site out outside of Broken Hill hasn't seen much impact from fires yet. So let's keep our fingers crossed. I come from Southern California, so we have quite a lot of wildfires there as well. So it's just, I think it's something that I've gotten, unfortunately, used to being surrounded by bushfires, but I guess the scale is just immense. I don't think the world's never seen fires on this scale before. And I think it's up to now, is it 1 billion animals they've estimated have died in the fires? Which, yeah, I mean, I can say the office has been a pretty depressing place lately. I think quite a lot of people have had study sites burned and wildlife that they've studied burned. A few species-specific researchers have had a bit of a rough time. It's definitely not been a great few months, and I'm sure it's not going to be a great few months ahead. But I guess the only thing you can really do at this point is hope that, I don't know if it's acceptable to call up the government, but that they get their act a bit together, not just in Australia, but globally, start putting, you know, climate action as a forefront, right at the front of what needs to be sorted out in the next few years.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about some of the field work that you did in Thailand near Chiang Mai. Working with semi-wild elephants. Can you tell us about some of the factors that are impacting these elephants in this part of the world?
The program that I worked on, essentially what we did was we paid elephant owners the same amount that they would make in, say, a working camp or a tourist camp where elephants would entertain tourists. So through donations and through funding, we would use money to pay these the elephant owners and say, hey, you'd be making the same amount of money or maybe a little bit more, but would you, instead of having your elephants in these camps, would you come have them live in this area of forest that's protected or owned by the village that I was working in? It was a really nice program in the fact that a lot of these elephants did come from a tourist or working camp background. I think the oldest elephant we had may have been in her 50s. So she's quite old, and had crossed international borders, and she'd been all through working camps. And it was kind of a nice to see elephants that had spent so long in captivity in probably not ideal conditions to be in a semi-natural environment. This was pretty much untouched forest. And we would go out with groups of volunteers and go out and kind of take down some data on elephant behavior and how they were interacting with each other and their environment to try and see if these elephants could be semi-reintroduced back into the environment. Each elephant had their own mahout or trainer that would go out into the forest every day with them and essentially walk with the elephants so they knew where they were, because there's no fencing or there's nothing like that. So, and it was kind of just an incentive of, we are giving you the money that you'd be making in these tourist camps, but your elephants would be much better off on a welfare side of things. So it was kind of that incentive of it's for the elephants and giving them a much better life than if you then rather than them living in work camps or tourist camps where they're in many cases there are high levels of abuse.
Can you talk about their work in the tourist camps? Like what's wrong with going to Thailand and say, you know, riding on the back of an elephant?
I mean, a lot of it has to do with, my experience in Thailand is extremely limited. I wasn't there for very long, but it's a lot to do with how the animals are trained and how the animals are forced in a way to work. There's cases where elephants aren't being fed the proper diets or they're not being kept in the proper conditions. They're have forced to maybe work or perform all day. A lot of the performance tasks in tourist camps aren't natural. You know, I cannot speak for everyone because I know that there are tourist elephant centers outside of Chiang Mai and in other areas of Thailand that are ethical and that do put welfare first when it comes to elephants. And a lot of places have started moving over to, you know, no longer doing rides or no longer doing this, but you can still go and interact with the elephants. And but I think it's less about not visiting these places. It's more about just educating yourself and trying to find the most ethical places. Because a lot of these places do as well a lot of education and conservation work. And it would be a shame. I think it's a shame for a lot of people that blatantly go and say, I'm not doing any of this stuff, whereas some of it actually can be pretty good. It's just finding the good ones.
So just doing your homework before you go along to one of these places.
Exactly. It's doing your homework. There's actually a lot of, in Chiang Mai, there's quite a few elephant veterinary centers and a lot of places like that that you can go visit that rescue elephants, and you can still go and see them and kind of see the work that the center does. But there's none of the abuse or possible abuse of a tourist or work camp.
So I kind of trawled through your Twitter and I saw one tweet which you wrote saying, "Hi, I'm Matt and I am a herbivore ecologist and a fabulously gay queen who kills the selfie game. They were wrong. You can have it all. Hashtag LGBTQIA science." I guess this sums out how you identify yourself. But is there anything you wanted to add to that description?
Not really. I think it's really only during my PhD that I've been so out and open about my sexuality. And I'm quite a late bloomer when it comes to coming out and experiencing everything. And I think once I came out, I was kind of tired of secrets and tired of the consistently coming out. Because as they say, as a queer person, you never stop coming out. Every new person you meet, you essentially come out to. And I kind of just went, I don't want it to even be a question. So I waved that flag and put selfies everywhere and just live my truth wherever I am. So I think that tweet probably best does describe me as a person.
At the University of New South Wales, you completed an ally training for LGBTIQA+ awareness and inclusion. Yeah. I was just wondering if you could tell us quickly what that training covered and who was the training for and who attended it?
So when it came to, so I guess before I say anything about it, that the system has changed since I took the course. There's now been a revamp and the guy that runs the course now has really, I've actually worked with him. I went to the, they did a pre new course kind of, this is what we're thinking of doing to a group of people. Can you come in, kind of sit in and watch and tell us what you think? So I did that and they've revamped it. They've made it into, a really, really awesome course. It's mainly, I would say, aimed at people who aren't a part of the LGBTQIA+ community that don't know much about it or maybe want to know how the best way to interact with certain members of our community in a workspace, or even just out in, you know, your personal life as well. Just there's a lot of focus on proper the ways to ask questions, or, you know, the right way to say ask someone's pronouns, and how to kind of make your language and your space a bit more inclusive. When I took the course, it was more coverage on the different letters in our alphabet, our little gay alphabet. And I mean, there were even points where I didn't know a lot about, say, trans communities or intersex communities. And it was actually really, really beneficial for me to look at all this and be like, oh, I've actually never really thought or learned about, I mean, I've being relatively out, I was very much focused on, I guess, the G part of the letter and trying to figure out what that means to me. But I was like, oh, I've never really thought about the other one. So it was a really nice way for me also to learn a bit more about our community. But
So how far into the mainstream student population does this training go? It's obviously a voluntary thing, I'd imagine.
Yes. So it's voluntary training that goes out. Various emails are usually sent out when the course is on. I think it's run, I want to say, once a month, and for all students and staff. So most staff are encouraged to take the course. And then it goes out to, but it's open to everyone. It's open to students as well. I don't know if they've done it in the new courses yet, but something that I found really positive in the old course was they brought in, almost every time they did the course, a panel of people that are part of the queer community that could kind of just openly ask any or tell their story. And then everyone in the course was able to ask questions without any sort of judgment and just be like, hey, like, what about this? And what about this? And so I sat on that panel a couple times. It was actually really interesting because a lot of times I was asked certain questions that I ever never really thought about myself. But I mean, I'm a very, very open person. So I've never had an issue talking about my sexuality. But yeah, there are times when questions pop up and I'm just like, oh, I've never really thought of that.
Well, good luck with your field research that starts next month. And thanks for talking with Experiment Q.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.